Another dilemma that citizenship theorists face is citizenship is, in a sense, quintessentially a universalist concept that is about equal status, or at least universalistic within the bounds of a nation state, and that we have equal status against this kind of yardstick for us all. And therefore, some people argue that it's not a concept we should be using these days, because not because we shouldn't all have equal status, but because it promotes what's been called a false universalism that ignores that there are differences between us, differences that we, not the differences of poverty and so forth that we want to erase, but differences that are important to people, differences between women and men, differences between ethnic groups, differences between disabled people and non-disabled people, differences of age, sexuality. And I think part of the, what we might call the project of a radical approach to citizenship is to try and build into this universalist concept a notion of difference. Now, it's difficult to do, and a number of us are struggling with it at present, so I haven't got an easy answer for you. But I think it is, it's partly about trying to break down the kind of way we think in dichotomies, that either it has to be universalist or it has to be about particularist and each group being different. We have to find ways that we can transcend these dichotomies and bring the two together.
I asked Ruth Lister what she felt were the differences between men and women in relation to citizenship.
One of the dilemmas in thinking about citizenship for women is, do women want to claim their rights as citizens as, quotes, equals with men, or as, quotes, different from men? Now, I'm not using the sense different in some essentialist sense that biological differences make all sorts of other differences, but that because of the sexual division of labour, women still have a domestic role that men, by and large, don't have, which constructs the contours of their citizenship. And it's a role that many feminists would argue we should not devalue. We shouldn't say that the answer is simply to get women into the labour market to be like men, you know, and not worry about the issue of care, because care in itself is important. I mean, care takes place in the public and the private sphere, paid in the public sphere, unpaid in the private, by and large. So there are some that would argue that we've got citizen the carer and citizen the worker. Citizen the worker is privileged when it comes to social security rights and so forth. Citizen the carer does very badly. So what do we do about that? There are some people who would argue the answer is to pay citizen the carer as if it were paid work, and that's the only way of valuing it. But the problem is, if you do that, the danger is that you then cement the sexual division of labour, because being realistic, you're never going to pay citizen the carer the same sort of wage rates that citizen the worker is getting, even probably citizen the low-paid worker. So it will continue to be women who are citizens the carers, perhaps even more locked into the private sphere than they have been in the past, or they are at present. But I think part of the answer does go back to this question of trying to shift the sexual division of labour itself, so that everyone is a citizen the carer and everyone is a citizen the worker, and you have the opportunity to combine the two. And that goes again back to social policy issues about, quotes, what are now called family-friendly employment policies that make it easier for both women and men to combine paid work. Family responsibilities, not just the care of children, but also, increasingly important, the care of older people.
As you've seen while you've been studying D218, Marshall has identified social policy as the critical mechanism for promoting equal rights. He calls it the social rights of citizenship. As Ruth Lister shows, it's often women whose rights are compromised as citizens.
I think social policy plays a crucial role in thinking about citizenship, and it's very important that political theorists ground their theories in social policy. And examples range right across the social policy field. I mean, a very simple one, which I found my students were quite surprised by, but very interested by, was the question of public transport. They hadn't thought of that as a woman's issue. But when I gave them some reading around, you know, that women have less access to private transport, when they thought about their own lives, about sometimes being afraid to go out at night on your own, waiting at dark bus stops and so forth, So if you don't have access like that, it's actually making it harder for women to be fully participating in the public sphere, which is where citizenship is traditionally seen to lie in its active sense. Also, women's access, say women with children, their access to public transport, which is, again, a parallel issue for disabled people. So questions of access, in that way, social policy is crucial. The women's position in the labour market. In modern days, it's been said that whereas in the past military service was the key to citizenship, today it's paid employment. And it's a key to citizenship in the sense that in most countries, many social rights through the benefit system are tied to employment status. So if you don't have full employment status in terms of a wage earning record that has brought you contributions for the social security system, then you're outside that core contributory benefit system and either have to end up relying on means tested benefits or relying on a working partner. And that, in my view, is incompatible with full citizenship, that you're not able to earn your own rights to social security benefits. If you look at Scandinavia, it's an explicit goal of public policy to try and shift the sexual division of labour within the family. So, for instance, parental leave in one or two Scandinavian countries, there's now a month of that that is reserved for fathers. If the father doesn't take it, you lose it altogether. And that's been a deliberate attempt to get men more engaged in the business of child rearing in the hope that they will then do more later on as well. There are a whole range of ways that social policy underpins women's citizenship. And it goes back to T.H. Marshall's notion of the political, civil and social rights. And of course, social policy is quintessentially about the social rights, but those three sets of rights aren't separate. They all interlink. And in some ways, it's the social rights that have to underpin the others.
Ruth Lister. Another important area of social policy in relation to people's rights as citizens is education, as you've seen in Book 2. I talked to Professor Madeleine Arnott about education and citizenship.
They say that the education system, the educational institutions, are the modernist project par excellence. They actually capture the nature of a modern society by saying that they're training the modern citizen, the modern worker. And it is this notion of training the citizen is precisely what the state education system was all about. You set minimum standards, as somebody would say, minimum competencies of what you want the citizen to have. You also have notions of ethical virtues, of values, of rules of conduct that you already have built into the education system. So the whole project is about education of the citizen. That then leads into the choice of curriculum, the approach that you take in history and English literature. You're teaching all sorts of principles and rules about the citizen through the content of the curriculum. So we're already learning what it's like to grow up in Britain, be part of British society at every point in the school system. It's not something that's outside of it. It is what it was there for. It's one of its tasks, is to create social order. What we haven't done very often is make that explicit. It's now become much more implicit in our culture and in the forms of knowledge that we teach. But that is why we've had so much contestation about how do you teach British history, whether you should teach Shakespeare, whether you should teach Englishness, or whether you should teach something that's more international.
So education has a role in creating the modern citizen. But what does this mean for women? Does education have a role in addressing their different life opportunities? Madeleine Arnott again.
You have to be conscious that you have to be aware of differences between women, that women experience citizenship rights differently, they experience participation differently, and therefore you can use it as a concept, as a vehicle to explore difference. You can also analyse classrooms in terms of the construction of difference between different sets of pupils by ethnicity, by age, by social class. So you could either do it through the analysis of the processes of construction of difference and how those differences emerge, or you could do it through a political education that actually makes those differences explicit, and then you start working with it. And for example, if you take the slogan that they use in Denmark about equal valuing of difference, if there is an argument that if you make the differences explicit rather than hide them, you can actually then start to learn how to value them equally. But that means really finding strategies for teaching that articulate difference rather than pretending they don't exist.
Madeleine Arnott. Citizenship as a notion has produced a rallying cry for different pressure groups to focus on. and has led policymakers to begin to acknowledge and take account of equal rights for all citizens. Helen Mikosha.
One of the most exciting things for disabled people has been the growing rise of the disability movement, both in the UK, the US, Australia, and indeed across the world. And many of the new, not new rights, but many of the breaking down the barriers have been occasioned by people taking to the streets, by lobbying, by organising themselves. In Britain, I think one of the most powerful and impressive social movements is the disability movement. There are issues, of course, for women in any social movement. Issues about women not necessarily being at the forefront, issues about women doing the background organising work and not taking the power and learning to negotiate and lobby at the head of the movement, if you like. Nevertheless, women have been extraordinarily successful. In the UK, as an Australian, I watch with wonder as the Disability Action Network organised around the country, chaining themselves to buses and trains and doing terribly brave things. Blind women, women with hearing impairments, women using wheelchairs have taken on the forces of the law in order to get their rights.
Professor Ruth Lister is also excited by the growing pressure from women in Europe.
We're seeing, on the one hand, women tending to be more active citizens at the very local level, but also now being citizens at the global level through networking around United Nations conferences and so forth, and international alliances around home working and things like that. But still, somehow, we get lost in many countries at the national level in between. Similarly, at European Union level, I think women have made quite an impact. And gender issues are very much on the agenda of the European Union. I think too much is sort of still constructing women as a homogenous group and not taking adequate account of the needs of minority group women, migrant women, and so forth. But at least because equal opportunities between women and men is part and parcel of the remit of the European Commission, it has, I think, given... Well, it's certainly in the UK and many other member states, it's enhanced women's rights as citizens.